Just one announcement before we start. For the speakers and the discussants and everybody else who's sat up, just a reminder, we're going to start shortly after the final talk today. So we said we'll be in the bistro by 6:15. So don't wander off, get involved in the discussions. It will bad things will happen to us. Start without even.
And it's a pleasure to have Rüdiger Schack here, and he's going to tell us about subjective privilege in many ways. Rüdiger.
Thank you, Adrian and John and David for inviting me to the conference. In a way, I'm barely qualified to speak on many worlds, because the only print contribution I've ever made to this topic is this paper in the middle here, where I didn't even know it was about many worlds when it was written. So this was an extended comment on the paper by David Deutsch that was talked about a lot yesterday, when Deutsch's decision theoretic derivation of the Born rule. And what we did in our 1999 paper was to basically point out that Deutsch's derivation was incomplete. There was an axiom, an important assumption missing there. And we proposed a different decision theoretic approach to probability in quantum mechanics, independent of many worlds. And basically, our axiom system was to take the original set of axioms by Savage, classical decision theoretic axioms, and supplement this by the assumptions of Gleason's theorem, which from our point of view, which is a Bayesian view of quantum states, actually makes a lot of sense and is a very innocuous additional assumption. So only learned from David Wallace later. I should say that these years are the years these papers appear on the archive, so they are probably not the publication dates in all cases. But so only learned from David Wallace that Deutsch's concern was many worlds, and that the additional assumption that we identified was extremely natural in the many worlds interpretation. I think Wallace sometimes goes even as far as saying it's unavoidable in the many worlds interpretation. But after the discussion of yesterday, I think this is certainly not an uncontroversial statement. In a way, deriving the Born rule isn't a problem for most approaches to quantum mechanics, because you really, if once you have got the Hilbert space formulas, you only have to give a small nudge, and you've got the Born rule out. And so, most approaches to quantum mechanics don't find it difficult to derive the Born rule. They just make an additional assumption, which is from this perspective, very natural, but it remains an assumption. I go very much with Wojciech on this, who said this, phrased this very nicely yesterday. He said, these facts are really assumptions. So that, I think, that should apply and does apply, I think, to all derivations of the Born rule in this context. I have another couple Well, I should say that David Wallace rephrased. What he showed, among other things, even again independently of many worlds, is that you can the axiom system you need to derive decision theory probabilities in quantum mechanics is much more elegant and much simpler than if you start from a classical theory and then add something quantum mechanically. So that's a very elegant and I think beautiful work. Saunders yesterday made some very strong statements here. He says this argument, Wallace's argument, will be a philosophical milestone if it stands up. And of course, that's the big question, does it stand up? And I'm going to address this today. He said something else. Saunders said that Wallace's approach solves problems in foundations of probability that have never been solved before. And of course, that Deutsch's approach, the Deutsch-Wallace approach, could be, okay. So that's a strong statement, and that leads me, and because it almost forces one to very carefully scrutinize the connections to the foundations of probability. So if you look at the argument from a foundation of probability viewpoint. And that's what I'm going to do in this talk. The decision theoretic approach to probability, I think, was pioneered by Leonard Savage in this book, which is available, still available as a Dover book, which it's a very beautiful book. He came up with a set of, he starts, the main terms in this approach are decisions, acts, and consequences. He basically starts from the notion that some agent will have some set of preferences between acts. Acts are maps from states of nature to consequences. The idea being you act in some way, basically take an umbrella if you go out, and then depending on the states of nature that occur later, you will face different consequences. And so if you have a system of preferences between acts like that, any system of preferences which obeys certain axioms like transitivity and a number of very reasonable axioms, you can actually derive formalism of probability. You can derive that these the preference order between these acts is governed by maximizing expected utility in the usual way. So probability pops out. You don't put it in. All you put in at the beginning is these preference orders. Okay. Now, if I had known that yesterday, there was three talks yesterday devoted to the Deutsch wallet approach. Not a single one stated the decision theoretic axioms of most agreed in Wallace's version are very elegant. I don't do it either because I didn't know it wouldn't happen yesterday. But if I had known, I would have actually stated them. I'm going to do a different route. The original Savage axioms are complicated. They are powerful and they are good, but they are quite formal. And there's a much simpler way of deriving. You make more assumptions. Assumptions aren't as clear in what I'm going to do here now. But I'm going to show you the Dutch book approach to decision theory, and the idea is that the decisions you're making here are restricted to whether you want to buy or sell a lottery ticket. It's worth $1 if E is true, and the idea is that your decisions are going to be governed by something you regard as the fair price for the ticket. So if the selling price is bigger than your fair price, you are you're willing to sell it. If it's smaller, you're willing to buy. So what you regard as the fair price is a guide to your actions in this way. And so basically, you say the agent says, well, what it means to assign a probability is basically determining what a fair price is. So and then one shows that this fair price has all the properties of probability. And the argument runs like this. If the only thing you demand is that the agent's probability assignment or ticket valuations are not incoherent in the sense that they should not lead to a sure loss. So if you lose money for whatever event takes place in the end, well, then you are incoherent. And the absence of incoherence, called coherence, alone implies these four, well, very familiar probability rules. And it's for the argument that you're quite useful to go through them one by one. I'm going to do this quickly. Everybody in the audience will be probably aware of this, but it's often useful to point out that this argument derives the probability rules for actually a single one. It's nothing to do with long run. There's many arguments that attempt to show that if you don't obey the probability rules, you will lose in the long run. This argument shows that you will lose in a single instance, in a single transaction. So the rules, the first one is probability must be non-negative. It's very easy to see, because if you regard a negative amount of money as a fair price for a ticket, well, you're willing to sell a ticket for a negative amount of money, so you will definitely lose money, however. The second rule, is that if the agent believes that the event is certain, if in that case the agent still regards that the fair price is less than a dollar, less than the payoff, then she is willing to sell a ticket which is definitely worth a dollar to her for less than a dollar. So that's a sure loss. for whatever happens.
That's important. It is your beliefs and your preference system that is in here. You know that this will definitely happen. But if you take your preference system, if you analyze your own preferences, if you don't find by analyzing them that you come up with a sure loss situation, you should regard them as incoherent and not useful.
Another point, but when you say a sure loss, that means that Alice believes that she will surely lose.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's the only thing that matters. And the third rule, well, that's the most substantial one in a way, is the additivity rule. Well, you regard three tickets. H is the union of the three events, so they're mutually exclusive. And so let's say B and F are the individual events. So you've got these three tickets, and the
fair prices that govern your actions are these three here. It's very easy to see that this ticket is exactly the same as these two combined. For whatever happens, these two give you the same payoff as this one. So if the sum of these two, of the two red prizes, were different from the blue prize, you can easily arrange a transaction in which you would lose whatever the outcome. So therefore, the sum of these two must be this, unless if you want to avoid a sure loss. The most interesting, in a way, is the fourth one, the conditional probability rule, because it shows you that these fair prices really define what the probabilities are. We don't have a notion of probabilities in the background, which we're trying to justify. These are the probabilities, and this is very clear in this case here, where this conditional probability P of E given F is defined as the fair price for this kind of ticket here. So this pays a dollar if F occurs and F is true, and E is true, then it pays a dollar. If F is false, if the condition is false, the bet is off. So basically, the price of the ticket is refunded. And that's this is the scenario which defines the conditional probability in this approach. And then you can just go through the same motion as before. You just come up with two tickets which are which together are exactly equivalent to that, and then you just with a small you think that these two must be the same as that, otherwise you get a sure loss, and you, with a small manipulation, you find the conditional probability rule.
Or preference rules be derived with positive stakes, or do some of them require negatives?
The stakes are always positive. You're really talking about buying or selling a ticket that's worth $1 if one. Actually, this is different here, right? Because here you need a payoff that's different from $1. But they're positive in this case. But you buy and sell. There's a different version of this where I should say two things. There's two big assumptions here which I have to spell out. One is that these compound bets that you're considering here, doing all these three bets in a single compound transaction, that you would actually follow these valuations here, even in that case. And the other assumption is that they have a linear utility, because as you just pointed out, this price here is not $1. So you have to assume that it scales linearly, which again, of course, cannot be not the case. So this, it keeps very much the spirit of these derivations, but it's not as clean and clear cut as these more formal approaches. Okay.
So this is, the important thing is here that you have absolutely no prior content of probability, but you derive something that guides your actions and that behaves exactly like probability. And that's the thing that matters here. And Dutch Book in Many Worlds, well, the Deutsch Wallace approach. It's actually very, very seductive in a way, Because if you apply this to many worlds, you have a very similar situation. You you have an action now, by your cell now. Then the world splits into branches. All these branches are real. So in each branch, you have a net payoff. And then you can, if you use the Dutch book arguments, you can actually derive the probability rules just from the assumption that you do not want the payoff to be negative in every branch. So that's clearly, it's almost, it seems almost more appropriate to use this Dutch book argument in the many worlds context than one where only one branch occurs. So it looks very much the same. Of course, there's lots of questions it's not all clear to me that the idea of having compound bets is easy to justify in this many world scenario. So the Dutch book scenario, it isn't clear to me, and I don't think anybody has really studied this, whether the Dutch book derivation in many worlds can be made to work as nicely as more formal decision theoretic axioms. But the spirit is the same here. What now before the branch? So
why does it matter whether the branches are real as opposed to real possibility?
Well, I mean, basically you said that the argument is
actually
not
exact.
Maybe there's a personal case. I thought it would be a seductive and therefore worth exploring.
Is it consistent with special relativity where the notion of now is ambiguous? For space and separated?
I don't think it matters.
No. Okay.
It doesn't matter. I mean, there's one thing I want to stress now. Savage doesn't just start with a set of axioms and derives decision theory from it. He also very strongly states that these probabilities he derives in this way are the only probabilities. And he's got a whole chapter on applying these, I think he calls them personalistic, let's call them subjective probabilities, to physics. And argues quite persuasively that they are all you need in, say, classical statistical mechanics. And that, of course, is the part where the many worlders depart from this approach. Let me just say now how this works, because in a sense what he is saying is there was a lot of talk yesterday about probability, about credence, chance, and frequencies. What Savage argues, and what others before him have argued definitely most famously, is that you can actually connect credence, what I would call probability, subjective probability, subjective degrees of belief, and frequency without going via chance. And so you don't need the concept of chance for that. And that works via the definitive representation theorem, the concept of exchangeability. So the idea is very, very simply that if you have a sequence, if you have something that might qualify as a sequence of repeated experiments, in this case you're for exemplified by a binary random sequence of binary random variables, and exchangeability is the judgment that the probability is permutation invariant, these assignments, so it doesn't matter in which order you look at your data. And secondly, it doesn't matter that how many you've got. So you can, in principle, think of this as an infinite sequence of probability assignments here. The idea is it doesn't matter to you that it is exactly the specific number. You would still think it's symmetric if it was more. So there's no notion that it stops somewhere. And if you have this judgment here, then you can actually derive that this probability assignment here must have this form, which is just a mixture of Bernoulli distributions. Andrazkov is just a very familiar, it is a very familiar expression which allows you to make connection to frequency directly using just the standard mathematical tools that elementary probability theory gives you. So it allows you to predict frequencies and maybe even more importantly to learn from frequencies. So the subjectivist using this theorem here can just, like anybody else faced with a repeatable situation, learn from frequencies and make frequency predictions.
PFQ is a measure. PFQDQ is a measure which, if you have an exchange for signals, is actually uniquely determined by that sequence. So this we would call your prior. But and you can, I mean, if you learn a frequency data, you update that.
So the theorem is that how can only there exist PFQ such that there is an implied there exists PFQ. Is there?
Yes.
And you get frequencies, you have to take n as being frequent.
No. I'm talking about finite frequencies here. You get, I mean, frequency data, and you get frequency data, and you update this, and this gives you then updated and better frequencies for future frequency data. So that works fine.
Now I'm going to move on to do something that David Wallace actually already did very persuasively yesterday, namely showing why classically you don't have chance really. Let's see if I
should actually go through this. Then very quickly, if you teach the engine probability which I do at university,
you always run into this problem here. This is a standard question: probability that in a family with two children, exactly one child is a boy, and you will always find a student who finds a third, and because there are just three possibilities. It's not a joke, actually. So
this is the
argument, and I mean it's they often even write it down very nicely. They're all equally likely, so they're all, this isn't exhaustive, so therefore probably is a third. Then the standard response is, well, of course, the conventional reply, well, there really are four possibilities, and they are all equally likely, and therefore you get one half of the probability. Right? But then the student comes and says, and again, I get this reply. Well, but didn't you tell me that the order, I mean, doesn't the statement of the problem tell you that the order in which boy and girl come is irrelevant? And therefore, why do you take this into account? And, okay, there's ways of arguing around that, but it's very hard to convince students. And in a way, they're right. Mathematics doesn't tell you one or the other. You just start from different probabilities, and then if you apply the axis of probability theory don't tell you which answer is correct. They only tell you how to get from this prior to the answer or from that prior to the answer. You will say, well, look, I mean, there's some facts behind that, right?
So 4.07.
So this is close enough to open 5. So therefore, that's what we have. But of course, this line of argument here makes the assumption that we select a family at random from all two children families, and this at random, of course, is highly complicated. The at random is again a prior assumption. So the point here is to make an important distinction here between the real situation in classical deterministic theories, the proportion of families. Is a real fact, but then there is always a prior probability, namely that it's equally likely here, which cannot be derived from anything. So the probability just depends on both these things. And I mean, here's my favorite Dilbert cartoon, which I think completely captures what's difficult about random numbers. Well, there's a prehistory why he's covered with all kinds of stuff here. Like, that's right. So we make a category distinction here. And I think almost everybody makes it between real situations, facts, and probabilities, and these are an agent's degrees of belief. And you just shouldn't mix these. All this argument goes somewhere. So, I mean, it's very hard to convince people that all probabilities are ultimately subjective. So they will say, oh, I mean, look at this here. This is clearly, I mean, 1/37th if you have 37. I think Las Vegas has 38 of them, right? But I think European casinos have only 37 fields. So the probability that, say, 15 comes up is 1/37. So this should be an objective probability. Until you read this amazing story here, which I don't think could have happened in Las Vegas, but these people actually used a laser scanner. They used the fact that you can still place a bet when the ball is already running around the thing. So you can still a small window where you can place bets. And they used some laser device to measure the velocity of the wheel and the position and the ball and predicted, well, better than a 1/37th what the outcome would be, and made $1 million. Oh, yeah, it was, I mean, they made $1 million, which, and when this is technology, this is an old hat. People did this in the 70s with toe operated device on their shoes in Las Vegas. There's a famous book about this Newtonian casino.
Exactly, because the eudaimonic pie was the original title of the book. So now it's very easy to do. The remarkable thing about the story is that they could actually keep the money. That didn't make any problem. So the question is, the serious question, what's the real probability? 1/37, let's say 1/3.
Because that's what the device computed. Or is it 1 or 0? Because if you specify exactly how the ball runs, so is this the old thing in the deterministic world, there is no objective, there is no chance here. Still, I mean, there is lots of attempts to connect chance and when I say probability, I always mean subjective based on probability. We come to the principle now, which is Lewis's attempt to to connect probability and chance. And it just states that the following principle may be a rationality constraint, that if you have an event E or a chance set up leading to an event E, and you know that the chance of E is Q, then you should assign probability Q to that to guide your actions. Now, I mean, that looks like a very almost ridiculous thing to do, but actually it is. This is a serious attempt to give empirical content to chance. Because only this principle, if you don't have it, you can't do what I do now here. Let's say Q is the chance of heads. And probability of Q is an agent's subjective prior beliefs about this chance, say for a single coin flip. Then you can just write down say your prior for n flips, and which has the same form as the definitive theorem, which the usual mixture of Bernoulli distributions. And then you can use frequency data to update probability of Q and can actually get evidence about what Q really is. And the principle just enables you to do that. Of course, classically, that fails. There is no chance classically, as I just tried to argue. And here's a different way of seeing that. Because the problem is that you can't say the chance of exactly what you're looking at. If you say that the chance of, if you have a coin and you say chance of heads, well, I mean, again, David Wallace gave nice examples here. Flip this coin, I get heads. Flip it again, get heads. Flip it again, get heads. Flip it again, get heads. And you tell me, well, you're not flipping it right. Because I've learned the trick of how to flip it, so I always get heads. So you have to say how to flip the coin. And the fact is just classically, if you say exactly how you flip the coin, you always get the same outcome. So it's basically only situations corresponding to chance 0 or 1 can be unambiguously defined classically. In case 1, if you give the initial microstate, you just get chance 0 or 1. Second case you might have is that you have some non-trivial degrees of belief about the initial microstate. So you say, well, I just don't know what it is, but I have degrees of belief about it, then your chance becomes subjective. So you just don't get what you want. And in case 3, you might say, well, there's the chances of different microstates are given. Well, in that case, you get an infinite regress because you rely on chance in order to define the chance of this event. So this is just a way to say classically why the principle in a classical world, does not achieve its goal of connecting chance with probability. Or I don't know. Okay. Now my point is going to be that this same argument still holds quantum mechanically. So the question is, can we now do the same thing with Savage programming quantum mechanics? And the answer is definitely yes. There is, first of all, the work I've been doing in the last few years with Carl Caves, Chris Fuchs, about quantum states representing an agent's decision theoretic degrees of belief. And that's the Bayesian approach to quantum mechanics, which I think works, successful. There's mathematical successes. In this context, in this decision theoretic or Bayesian approach to quantum states, Gleason's theorem plays a role. Chris Fuchs has very, very well argued that the assumptions behind Gleason's theorem are more or less natural, unavoidable facts, but assumptions, of course. In this context, there's a quantum definitive theorem which connects frequencies, measured frequencies, with quantum states in exactly the same way that the classical definite representation theorem connects probabilities, subjective probabilities, and frequencies. So the problem of connecting your states, your quantum state assignments, with measurement outcomes is solved by that. Even in practically very convenient ways. What is this quantum version of Savage's axioms, which is also something that is mathematically simple, compelling, and beautiful. And so it's a successful program. Yes, Gleason's theorem, I'm not going to go through that. I'm going to say very briefly something about the quantum definitive theorem, just because, this establishes the connection between the subjective quantum states that I'm advocating and measured data, frequency data. And so, you have the concept of exchangeability, and it's exactly formulated like in the classical case. So a state is exchangeable if it's symmetric and extendable. So so each row n is invariant under permutations of the system. So the order in which you make measurements doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter how many of them you've got. And if you have these assumptions, then you can show that the density operator has this nice form. It's just a mixture of IID states. And that was originally proved by Hudson and Moody, and we found an elementary proof of it later.
Is there a way to
relax something like an approximate exchangeability?
Yes, definitely. And there's a lot of work on that
very recently by Renato Ravenna and by other authors. There is a finite exchangeability, which is one of them, where you just relax the second condition, the extendability condition, and then you get approximate. And there's also there's different ways actually of defining approximate exchangeability. So there's a whole body of work on that recently.
Okay, so here it says
quantum mechanics is nice because things it's much easier to write down things than in classical probability theory. So this is why I put here an explicit way of how a Bayesian would regard quantum tomography. Because one typical way of saying, it just can't be true that a quantum state is subjective, just expresses subjective probability, is that you can measure the quantum state by tomography. And here's how we would look at tomography. So you start with n plus m systems, and you make the exchangeability judgment or assumption. Then the definitive theorem gives you this prior state. You then measure n subsystems you get a vector of outcomes, let's call this alpha here, and then it's very almost trivially you get an updated state where, well, you have a posterior p of rho given alpha here, and which is typically more peaked. So in this sense, you hone in on the state if you make this initial assumption, but you do not need the concept of an objective state or of chance in this at all. Okay, so now we come to the main argument. If you want to apply the decision theoretic approach to many worlds, you really need something like two kinds of quantum states. You need belief states for decision making, just like the states I just talked about in the context of definitive theorem, and you need the real states, a real state of the universe, a real state of your of the stuff in your lab, which comes from the the many worlds theory. This is not how Deutsch and Wallace formulated this, but it's easily seen that this is equivalent, because a state is, I think in Michael Wetter's word, a compendium of probabilities. If you write on a state, it's the same thing as writing down probabilities for a set of measurements. And if the set of measurements is sufficiently rich, then you can there's a one-to-one correspondence. So states and probabilities are really the same thing in many ways. So just like this way of saying. So if there's two kinds of quantum states, once you use for decision making, once you write down that express your bets, your preferences, your beliefs of what frequencies you will measure, and then there is the real states. And what the Deutsch-Wallace rationality constraint really gives you is sort of a quantum principle. I don't know if they would call it like that, but that's really very much the essence of it. You could phrase it like this: the belief state of a system, given that the real state is Q. That's the content of the Deutsch-Wallace claim. And if this could be derived, that would be remarkable, as Simon Saunders said in the words I just quoted earlier in the talk. So this would, and you need this in order to give the true state, the real state of many worlds, content. To connect it to measured outcomes, to give it empirical, that's the word I was looking for, to give it empirical content, you need this kind of principle if you think that the frequency root is bad to you. And I mean, I'm fully agree with David Wallace that the attempts to directly connect chance and frequency have failed. So you need this quantum principle to connect the state of the universe, the state of many worlds, with measurements, and to give this state empirical content. And now the argument I'm going to give is that the argument that I used for in the classical case, why the classical principle doesn't work, or why the principle does not give you anything in the case of a deterministic classical theory, can be just used for quantum mechanics in exactly the same way. It's essentially no different. And in a way, in quantum mechanics, it's even easier to make the argument because there is no microstate underlying it. So the claim is, so the question is again, I'm questioning the that it is actually possible to say what the real state is exactly the state of. And the question, the real state of exactly what doesn't have a well-defined answer. So the claim that in quantum theory, the situation giving rise to a real state Q cannot be unambiguously defined. And we go through the same three cases as in the classical case. The first case it doesn't exist because it's impossible to. There's no quantum microstate, so it's impossible to actually give a classical microstate exactly describing the situation. So the 0-1. 0-1 case doesn't even exist here. Then there's a second case. Well, now you have to before I actually go through this, you have to say what actually, I mean, I'm talking about. Let's talk about a spin measurement. So you very often hear talk like this. You let's say you prepare a spin in an eigenstate, say an up eigenstate of sigma y, and then you measure sigma x. So my claim is that it is not possible to actually, without some circularity, to actually say unambiguously what you have to do to put a system in a sigma y eigenstate. You say, well, of course, I mean, you just prepare a sigma y eigenstate. But I think we all agree that quantum mechanics is the only thing we have to describe the world. There is no classical domain, or there's no separate classical world. So it's not possible to, in purely classical terms, define what you need to do to prepare a system in a sigma y eigenstate. You have to actually specify an apparatus, a measurement apparatus, a preparation device, and that's a quantum device. You cannot give just this, the classical microstate of this device to fully describe it. You have to, the correct description of the whole thing, preparation device and system, is a quantum state. So, in simple terms, there's just two cases, case two and case three. Case two is that the agent's initial belief state, the steady state of the apparatus and system to start with, is given. In that case, the state Q would become subjective as well, because if you need to quote the agent's belief about the initial state of the compound of the big system, in order to define what Q is, of course, then Q becomes subjective as well. And the second case is that the initial real state is given, so you give. Basically, you say, well, there is a real state of the whole setup. Well, then you get an infinite regress as before.
So that's basically the argument. There's just no difference
between the classical argument for why the principle doesn't give you anything and the quantum argument for why the Deutsch-Wallace argument doesn't give you anything. I want to just make this point that you need.
Maybe this is something I should save for later. If it is, just tell me. I didn't understand the argument.
I'm almost finished. So, and maybe this next slide is going to put some light on that. That is obvious from what? From the talk about it.
Various ways and techniques.
So here's a quantum information theory way of looking at preparation of a state. So the aim here is to prepare a system in a state zero, and that can be anything. That could be sigma y up, or that could be a polarization state of a photon in a particular basis. That's zero is the state we want to prepare. And this is the usual way in which preparations proceeds. You have a system which is in an arbitrary state initially. So you don't want to make any assumptions about the initial system state. And let's say your apparatus is in some sort of standard initial state. And let's call this zero. Then what you do is you entangle apparatus and system. And that's in quantum information terms, it's just achieved by a C-naught gate. So you get this entangled state of system and apparatus, alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. Then you perform a measurement on the apparatus. So you read off the point position, let's say. And this gives you a classical outcome, little a. That's your classical point of position. And so these double lines, they represent classical information, and the single lines, quantum state. And then, since you want a deterministic preparation procedure, you do a conditional flip. So if the outcome A is zero, you just don't do anything. If it's one, you flip the bit up there. And this is how you can deterministically prepare your system in the state zero. And essentially any preparation in terms of apparatus and system works like that. Now, there's a nice way of rephrasing that, because this the spin flip here, this conditional flip XA, and the measurement can actually be swapped without making any difference. But then when I've done that, when I've swapped the, when I actually do this flip before the measurement, then I don't need the measurement any longer. So what I get then is this second circuit here, which in terms of, I mean, it does the initial entanglement, and then it does the conditional flip in order to get the deterministic outcome, and it gets the same thing for the system, and all the apparatus is just in a state, but this is actually irrelevant for us here. We just achieve the same thing. And again, any deterministic preparation procedure can actually be phrased exactly in this way, and now it's nothing but a unitary interaction between system and apparatus. So any deterministic preparation procedure can be phrased like that. And then the point I was making, that the apparatus state matters, is just highlighted by this simple fact here that, and this is really a fact, that if your apparatus state is 1, well, then your system state afterwards will also be 1. And basically, this particular way of doing it, you can get any state up here, if you just put the apparatus in the corresponding state side on here. So the apparatus state matters, and so you have to just put this in. You cannot define this preparation device, the preparation procedure, without specifying the initial state of the apparatus in some way, and then I get my argument. Either you regard this as a subjective degree of belief, a belief state, or you regard this state of the apparatus as a real state. And in each case, you get I wouldn't call this case too, undesirable, but certainly I would regard this as making real states unnecessary. Okay, so I think I'll just skip this here and come to my conclusion. So, decision theoretic approach to quantum mechanics, yes. But decision theoretic approach to many worlds, no. And I should say the end of the argument I just gave, of course, does not just apply to many worlds, but it applies to any approach where you try to have objective, real quantum states out there and connect them via some sort of principle to belief states, to decision theoretic states. Yeah, thank you for your attention.
I just have a question. I mean, some people go around making theories in the initial condition of the universe. Are they proposing a belief state? Because they're proposing a theory of it, they believe it. Or is it the real state? Because the state of the universe is supposed to be. I've already asked them, and I don't get any answer.
What? They should blame me, but I think, although I'm really not a cosmologist in any way,
I think you can make progress by regarding the state of the universe as a belief state.
I mean, it's sort of aren't we doing that with anything? And so people make proposals for the Hamiltonian, right? Are they making belief assertions about the Hamiltonian?
I don't know about the Hamiltonian. This is really getting us somewhere else. What I've been proposing or defending here, but partially, because really it should have been about the many worlds, about the Dutch forest. But what I've been defending here is a belief approach for the states.
Let's do that. I will ask you the same question.
So look, I still didn't end up understanding the arguments we're making for there being no real state. Right, but no microstate. First question, just to orient myself. Is there any reason why exactly the same argument couldn't be made in classical mechanics?
Yeah, I think I thought this is what I was supposed to say. In classical mechanics, you can make this argument, and you just go through exactly the same way.
Oh, I see. But so that, I mean, how is this different from, say, Descartes' Marvin that maybe we're just dreaming? You don't know if your apparatus is in the proper state.
If it's you tell me you don't understand what I'm saying, you say something I don't understand.
Good. Myself is clear. The worry here seems to be a very familiar sort of worry. Look, how do we know our apparatus was initially in the state we thought it was? How do we know our sensory, our sense organs are functioning the way we think?
I think I can answer it because it's not at all what I was trying to say. This is not about how I know that something is the case.
Right.
This is about how I can define what I mean when I say, well, I mean, real is not exactly what. If you want to say it, I have a real state for a system in a certain situation, I have to say what this situation is in terms that are not certain. And that's, I'm claiming it impossible.
Because right, I don't see why it's impossible.
You cannot specify a preparation procedure without saying something about
the
state. Why
don't you put the slide up so you've got
So we approach this situation taking it to be the case that our apparatus is in state zero. Okay? But as a matter of fact, we make a mistake. Our apparatus is in state one. Okay? So for example, I wake up in the morning assuming that my brain is in such a state that I'm not going to see elephants in the room unless there are. Okay? But I'm wrong. My brain is in a different state. I'm going to see elephants in the room even if there aren't elephants in the room. Isn't that the full content of the work?
I thought what I just said. I mean, you just repeat what you said before. I said this is not about how do I know what's that. This is about can I actually say what I mean when I say the state of this system.
Good.
So I just say you cannot even say how to prepare what it means to prepare a system without invoking state stuff.
So here's a proposal for how to prepare it. Okay? I prepare a state of an elephant-free room in the morning by looking around the room and seeing no elephants. Period. What's wrong with this preparation procedure?
You might have the lights off.
I might be, the worry is I might be wrong about my mental state. I might be wrong about my brain state.
No, I think you're missing something. I mean, you're talking about elephants. They're clearly classical elephants. When you talk about
you said this goes through in the classical case just like in the quantum case.
Oh, yeah. Let's go to the classical case.
Let's go to the classic.
I just was more or less thinking that the classical case should be uncontroversial. Because in the classical case, I did my cross flip thing. In classical case, if I say exactly how I flip the coin, I get outcome 0, I get chance 0 or 1. If I don't say exactly how I do the coin flip, then I don't really say exactly what I'm doing.
Okay, we're talking past each other. Maybe we should continue this way.
You are. Yes.
Okay. I also want to get clear about what you mean about different things, but I don't think my words are the same as David. You say we can't specify the conditions. Can you put that slide up again where
the state
preparation can't be an ambiguously defined.
So which are
the quantum ones? Version of this slide. Okay, the situation giving me a punitive real estate can I be in and do this one. Now, suppose I'm a physics student, a budding experimentalist, and I want to know how to prepare a spin wire eigen state. And so my professor tells me what to do, and I go in the lab, and I think I do a good job. And we want to know whether I've prepared a spin wire eigen state. And me and my professor may have start with very different degrees of belief about whether I might have a high degree of belief, and he might be much more skeptical. But let's suppose that our initial credences are such that we think that a series of experiments done on that apparatus that I have created in the lab is exchangeable. Then we just do it and find out whether I did. Now, and If I get totally wrong statistics, then you know, no matter how confident I am initially that I did right, I at a certain point I say, okay, you're right, I screwed up. Now we're not going to convert to exactly the same degrees of belief about what that apparatus is doing. But if we do enough statistics, we'll get to the point where our differences in degrees of belief won't matter. And isn't that good enough? Isn't that all that the Deutsch and Wallace need, that we can go into the lab and get as much information about the quantum state as we want, so that subjective degrees of belief between reasonable agents won't matter?
And what they're saying is that in practical terms, in the lab, these distinctions don't matter that much. And I agree with you.
Okay.
So the subjectivist account of a repeated experiment is fully capable of dealing with the situation. There's just no, it can easily be phrased what they're doing in terms of, you even said we make the exchangeability assumption. If we make assumptions and we get frequency data and we draw conclusions, all that is perfectly, it can be perfectly phrased within the subjectivist framework. But we are talking here about something very different. We are not talking about how in practice people in the lab work. We are actually talking about some very fundamental issues. Is the universe splitting in many branches or not? I mean, this is a very different kind of question we're asking here. And if you ask this question, you have to be very careful about what your terms are. And I think if you really cannot say what it can say in unambiguous, non-circular terms, what it is, what it means to prepare something, then you're in trouble for this particular argument, because it's supposed to be a precise argument, not about what in practice you can do.
Okay, so I originally thought, that's cute, you can use a quantum state to represent as lean as well as the real thing. And now I think that doesn't really seem. So why, if you're serious about, that was the aggressive framework where we said a quantum state is lean, why isn't the agent's belief state probability measure of the Hilbert space?
Why isn't the...
The agent's belief state, I think it's probably spin up, but it might be one of the root 2 up last day, and it might be root 2 over 3 up, one over root 3 down. If states are real, queens like the master stars, they're not better than at all, because likely being quantum states represent those problems. Those states themselves are probably committed in the state space, i.e. the Niles. So why are you using
most of them? You can have these beliefs, but you can't connect them to reality. Because, for instance, you may want to make a repeated experiment. So you have to be at least be able to say in principle what you would have to do to repeat the conditions of the experiment each time.
But Rudiger, you're saying yourself that you're not talking about practicality here. In principle, I'm considering hypothesis called the quantum thing, the real physical thing, like the magnetic field, and I'm not sure which one it is. My graduate student over there prepared the system, but it tends to get the axes of its skewed, so probably it's been up, but maybe
the theory is not about an actual piece of. It's not that the question is because of this particular thing. But what you want to say in theory is that if I do something specific, the quantum state, you want to say what you have to do in theory. You want to say the size of the experiment and what you have to do in order to get a certain quantum state. It's not enough to say, if they have done something here, then I can make some hypotheses about the real state. Theory wants to be more than that.
Let me try once more. I mean, in classical mechanics, the Queen's function, the agent's subjective probability, is a unit measure on state space system, i.e. phase space. Why is that not exactly what should be going on in quantum mechanics, where the state space is the opposite? What's the dissonance? Why shouldn't that be the same thing?
One obvious reason is that classically you can actually this is a proper state What about the subspace? You can actually, once, but when you bet on these things, you can actually determine whether you've got the result or not.
If you have a
measure of a space, so you have a measure of things you can't see, that you can't ascertain. It's impossible to say whether you're right or not about what the state is. You can't bet on those.
Well, I mean, for instance, it might be the determining of the fact that somebody else wrote it down over there.
My argument is lost because I think I just gave an argument for what the difference is and why you wouldn't buy it.
We need to do it in order.
You go back.
Yeah.
How do you define the agent because of the beliefs that you mentioned? How do you define that?
That's a primitive of my
Is there any way...
It's one of your facts.
No. Isn't
so is it something? Is it something outside of physics?
The question is what do you want physics to do? And if you want physics to be a life for agents to navigate the world, you want physics to tell us how agents actually interact with the world, then not a lot, but it's just a core of physics. But if you ask me, is it something that is the agent, when is an agent outside the physical system he is looking at, then I say yes.
I've got two questions, but I'll ration myself to the more stupid one. I'm very puzzled by your quantum principle. You told us that a lot of people said it yesterday, so obviously I wasn't paying attention. But you say that there is a real state Q, and there is also a belief state, and these should be the same thing. That sounds highly non-evolutionary. In a many words superposition, the agents have only the relative state, which is very different from the real state. So the quantum principle ought not to be true.
Okay, so when I'm going to talk about the real state, actually, this is the real relative state.
The real relative state.
That they were talking about. Because you can actually derive the relative state from the facts about the branches and the real big state. And so that's what I'm talking about.
In that case, can I also have my other question, which goes back to what everybody's been talking about, your parallel between the quantum chances in an indeterministic or quantum world and chances in a classical world. And you convincingly showed us that the naive person who speaks this font surely a roulette has an objective chance, and the Hungarian woman and the two Iranian men showed us that that's not true, because there are microfates, and because you can refine the situation, a description of the situation you're talking about. Now, surely that person in the street would also say, surely, when I've taken the upper beam in a Stern-Gerland experiment for the y-axis, then the chance that will go in one of the two beams when I now go oriented in the x direction, surely that is an objective chance. And now you can't define this description. You can say you have problems like giving an exact quantum description, but the quantum description is robust. It doesn't matter if you're slightly wrong. It's still true that you will never, because there aren't any microstates. So how do you answer the naive student's question? Surely this chance is objective. In the situation where you have actually got an apparatus in front of you, you've sent the beam through the y-axis to the experiment, and now you're going to send it to an x-oriented one.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, the apparatus isn't specified in classical terms.
I'm taking a void. I've just given you a passage. I'm just talking about the real situation in the now. I want to know these chances in this now. You can't.
There is always a distinction here between the conceptual things and the practical ones. In classical mechanics, where I would probably call it a lot more agreement statistical mechanics, such as statistical mechanics in terms of subjective probabilities alone, microstates and subjective probabilities. You can similarly say, well, this is crazy. You go to the lab and you tell us what to do to measure a specific heat, and it does it. So, I mean, that argument is exactly the same flavor as the conceptual questions, I think, are your conceptual question is answered, but then the practical question is very similar to the one in the specific account.
Because the way you stretch, maybe
she's silent.
I think you were questioning something that I at least always felt to be not problematic, and that is to say the separation between questions of ontology and questions of probability. And it seems to me that in questions of ontology, we imagine, certainly the Dr. Deutsch Wallace approach, we imagine that just magically we're given the ontology, the query, branching structure, complete, you know. Okay, then the issue is, well, what on earth are we supposed to say for Melissa, for example? And then there's the whole issue of subjective views of being ought to be keys to those entities. Great. Fine. Now, you seem to be questioning that we do, as it were, have that ontology given to us, independent of presuppositions of the interpretation of the world, of the way it's as subjective views be. But that seems to be what you're doing.
I would say no. I say, even if you, let us assume you're given this ontology, then you cannot connect it to experience. You cannot give it, because I mean, the idea of the quantum principle of the Deutsch Wallace theorem is that it gives you a way, like the principle of the predicate, to connect credences and chances. And so that will give
credences and attitude squares.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I mean, but that is the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So the connecting the ontology and our preferences about one outcomes. So therefore, connecting our experience, our lab results, our empirical world with the ontology. And that's the thing that
I don't understand at all. Within the ontology, we can see, we're magically given the ontology, we can see a stone Gerlach-shaped bit of stuff, and we can see amplitude squares, states produced by that stone Gerlach-shaped piece of stuff, okay, with associated amplitudes, and then the business is, what frequencies should we attach to those microstates so produced? Fine. That's what we're about. You seem to be denying that we can even get to that starting point.
Yes. Anything you said didn't take anything from my question. This is mine.
In case three, classically, the reason why it's a little bit of regress is because if you go all the way to a precise state, then of course you've just got one and zero.
No, it's not. That's not the argument here. If classically you had something like a chance
deterministic classical, if you precisely the initial data, all you've got the ones and zeros.
Let's get off.
Now, the reason why case three takes you, the reason why it involves implicitly probability, you suppose the real state is given with some probability. That's what needs to be regressed.
So, in this case,
you specify the real state, but you don't make any quantum statement about probability. And this is the remarkable thing about quantum mechanics, of course, that doesn't mean that you're in case one territory.
No, exactly. I mean, my point here is that this one big difference between quantum and classical, namely that they are on microstates, doesn't matter to the argument.
Therefore, the case three doesn't have to be in the regress. There is no requirement to specify one mechanical, some probability associated with the initial zero state.
Losing a bit.
I think maybe this one should be continued.
Well, it's the key point. This is what your whole talk is about. Please, don't say discuss
it all.
What do you have to say?
Okay.
May I ask the same
question as Simon?
Excellent. Very diplomatic.
Let me beat a dead horse. Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to say what I think is your argument in my own terms. And let's at least see whether you agree with this. And tell me whether I capture it. So let's play, I'm Niels Bohr and you're Otto Stern. And I say, Otto, will you please make me a spin up in the Z direction? And you say, sure, I'll prepare one for you. Just tell me how to prepare it. And I say, well, I'm Niels Bohr, so I talk in classical language, and I'll draw you some pictures, and I'll put some big bolts on the cable, and that's how you prepare this spin up in the z direction. And you reply, that's not a good specification enough. This isn't the classical world, this is a quantum world. Tell me how to make a device. I say, Niels Bohr says, aha, right. Let me give you a more precise specification of the device. Let me not just use a picture of a Stern-Gerlach device with nuts and bolts and so forth. Give you a more precise specification, I have to specify a quantum state for the device. And you say, okay, I'll do that. Now tell me how to prepare that quantum state. And now I say, I'm Niels Bohr, so I'll tell you in classical language. and that's the infinite regress you're talking about. Now the many worlds are, let's see your response to this, the many worlds are would say, it's not an infinite regress, it bottoms out at the state of the universe. Now how do you reply to that?
This is not about, okay.
So we keep expanding, the devices that prepared the devices. And where does that go? Well, first off, did I capture your logic? I think I caught your logic.
Yes. I have a quick answer to that.
I think my reply would be that if we've agreed that the quantum state is subjective at the bottom level, then every time we trace it up, we might as well agree that it's subjective. Personal. Jim writes down a quantum state for the universe. He's writing down his degrees of belief about what he would find the baryon number to be, what he would find the Hubble constant.
You have to specify how to prepare Jim. I think we sort of ran into the coffee break. So I think we declare the rest of the discussion informal. In other words, if someone wants to stay here and argue, they are welcome. If someone wants to go after coffee, they are welcome.